Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome, welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians. Our AccuWindow forecast, 51 degrees and cloudy. Glad you could join us tonight. The solar wind is 382 kilometers per second, and the proton count is an average 1.9 per cubic centimeter. Not that you'd be out sunbathing today. There are 8 sunspot clusters active right now. I mean, the sun is loaded with them. But none of them pose a threat of a solar flare. However, a significant coronal mass ejection blasted away from the sun's eastern hemisphere yesterday. Analysts at the Goddard Space Weather Lab say the cloud will hit Mercury on November 13th, followed by Venus about one day later. There haven't been any strong solar flares in days. Nevertheless, some impressive activity is underway on the sun. For one thing, an enormous wall of plasma is towering over the sun's southeastern horizon. Now, it's not aimed at us. Many solar photographers are saying it is the largest they have ever seen. Very fortunately, it's not aimed at Earth this time. Remarkably, though, this is not the biggest thing. A dark filament of magnetism is snaking more than halfway around the entire sun. From end to end, it stretches more than 1 million kilometers, or about 3 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. If the filament becomes unstable, as solar filaments are prone to do, kind of like stretching a giant magnetic rubber band, it could collapse and hit the stellar surface below, triggering what we call a Hyder flare. No one can say if the eruption of such a sprawling structure would be Earth-directed. We just don't know right now. The Russians have been unable to communicate with their latest probe to the moon Phobos. This is their third attempt. You recall the first one was lost on the way to that moon. The second arrived in great shape, but it was blown to pieces while in orbit around Phobos by what its last photos indicated was a missile aimed directly at it. We covered this about a month ago on the program in pretty fair detail. This one is loaded with toxic fuel and will decay out of orbit in a very short time. What is it about Phobos that is so important that it appears someone or something doesn't want us to know any more about it? Interesting stuff. I want to let you know that the phone lines are open tonight, and I'm relying on you to help me. Toll-free anywhere North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet. And by the way, I've gotten a lot of mail from our listeners in Australia, and we really appreciate that. You can reach us at 530-413-4511, 530-413-4511. Also, never forget that you can tune into BBS Radio anytime without a computer. All you need is a phone. Dial in 760-569-7676, the passcode 192919, pound, and you'll be into a conference line where you can listen to the program live. You won't be able to contribute, but you can listen. A couple of other announcements. I want to let you know that remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel, is still selling pretty well on Amazon. I'm really surprised. The book is doing really well, still stuck there in the top 100 in our genre. And it's available to you on our website at rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Why would you buy it from our website instead of Amazon? That's a good question. You might save a couple of bucks on Amazon, maybe. But if you buy from our website, you get the entire book and audio for free, and you get it autographed. So it could be worth it. You get the free download the instant you buy, and then a few days later you'll get the paperback so that you can read it. And also want to let you know that I do speak at events for free. So if you want me to come and speak to a salon or your library or your school or university, I'd be happy to do that. The only thing we ask for is the transportation there and back and a little bit of room and board. That's it. As long as we can sell books and a few DVDs, I'm very happy. That being said, the news is out. I have been chosen to be a speaker at the Maya 2012 conference at, you guessed it, Chichen Itza. Chichen Itza, Ground Zero, December 21st, 2012. We'll leave Houston December 13th. I promise we'll be back before Christmas. We will arrive back in the States December 22nd. And boy, will you have an amazing story to tell your family gatherings on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. You don't want to miss this one. If you've been saving up, if you've been thinking about going to a conference, don't pass this one up. Wait for it. There's going to be a banner at xsquaredradio.com. I want you to click on that banner, and we'll have some specials and some incentives to help you get there and get back. You want to be there December 21st, 2012. Don't you? I want you to be there too. We've got room for thousands. Not that we're trying to sell it out or anything. I don't think it's really possible. But this is way better than being at any other power place on the planet on that day. This is where it's going to happen. Greg Braden, Power Places, Brooks Agnew, we will be there. And we'll be sharing what we think and what the ancients have left behind for us could be the ushering in of a great metamorphosis for the planet Earth, for the people, for the planet, for the social structure of humankind on the Earth. You want to be part of that. You want to be there to witness it. You have a year. Now, we don't want you to wait 11 months before you start putting your money in. So when you get that tax refund check, this is going to be the first thing on your list, because one of the most important things about being here on the Earth is you get to do great stuff. It, whole life is not have to, people. You get to do stuff, and this is one of them. And you're in the right place. You're in the right place. So watch for the banner, Maya 2012, Chichen Itza. Be with us there. I also want to let you know there's some website changes coming. It's by necessity because you have been listening so much, because we have been streaming so much audio information from xsquaredradio.com. We are now slowing down one of the biggest server companies in the country, and we have to get our own virtual private server to be able to handle the traffic. That migration takes some time. There's about 6 gigabytes of data that we're trying to move over. It could take as much as 2 or 3 weeks. But when we get it over there, then everything will run smoothly again. So if you have any problems listening to the archives, that's what it's caused by. We don't foresee any, but I just want to let you know in advance where we are making a migration, because the audience is growing, and we appreciate it very much. Even though it's a lot of work, it's well worth it. We appreciate you. Without you, we wouldn't be here. Relative to Earth weather changes, you know, we get mail. Wait, hang on a second. I got a Skype text coming in. Okay, I don't really want to talk about that. I'll say something about that. This whole Sandusky Penn State thing. I've been getting mail on it all week. What do I think about it? I'll give you my opinion at the end of this hour. I don't think it's, you know, really appropriate for X Squared Radio, but I do get people asking me what I think about it, and so I'm going to share that with you at the end of the hour. So hang tight on the Sandusky question, and I will get back with you. Weather strangeness. We have gotten a lot of email about climate change, global warming, global cooling. Who's right? Who's wrong? What political message do I listen to? What website do I align my? Where do I send my money? Do I build a shelter? Do I store food? Well, it's all out there. Everything's out there. And you know, we've talked to Alex Jones. We've talked to others about this, and of course, we've listened to many experts on survival and on, you know, taking care of yourself and your family and long-term, you know, federal emergency management stuff. And all of that's good advice, okay? You should store a little food, store a little water anyway, because you never know what's going to happen, whether it's going to be a tornado, a flood, a fire, or just a power outage, or, you know, heaven forbid, something worse. But climate change is upon us. There is no doubt about it. The jury is in. The judgment is in. The sentence has been delivered. Climate change is upon us. And it is affecting the weather in very, very strange ways. Records being set almost weekly now. Not only record heat in the summer, but record cold in the summer, record cold in the winter. We are not seeing major shifts in the Gulf Stream yet, okay? I've seen a couple emails on that. Not to worry. That's being monitored very closely. They've been watching it for 40 years. The Gulf Stream's still in good shape, still going where it's supposed to go. But an epic storm was bearing down on western Alaska on Tuesday, the National Weather Service said, warning that it could be one of the worst on record for the state. Now Alaska's, you know, not a state for sissies, okay? This is, you know, serious winter. I can tell you the heating bills are not too bad in the summertime up there. But the rest of the year, it's a real challenge to live. You get used to the cold. You get used to doing things in the cold. You get used to cold weather sports, cold weather entertainment, and cold weather living. So it is not a state for the tropical. The storm moving inland from the Aleutian Islands was expected to bring hurricane force winds with gusts up to 100 miles per hour. Heavy snowfall. You want to talk about snow drifts at 100 mile an hour winds. You get some serious snow drifts. Widespread coastal flooding and severe erosion to most of Alaska's west coast. The National Weather Service warned, quote, "This will be an extremely dangerous and life-threatening storm of an epic magnitude rarely experienced," the service said in a special warning message on Tuesday. Nome, as in Nome, Alaska, not the little guy on Travelocity, Nome and the rest of the Seward Peninsula, a section of land that juts out towards Siberia, are expected to be the hardest hit areas, said Andy Brown, lead forecaster for the National Weather Service in Anchorage. Powerful storms in the North Pacific and Bering Sea are common this time of year, but this event is unusual because of its trajectory, Brown said. It's going very far north. Posing an additional threat is the lack of sea ice off of northwestern Alaska, he said. The last time a storm of similar magnitude was sent in the same northward direction, it was 1974, but the sea surface was much more frozen then, he said. History tells that the sea ice helps subdue the storm surge. Of course it does. With all that ice in the way, it prevents the wind from really whipping up the ocean and pushing it toward shore. With no sea ice there, we could see the full brunt of that 6 to 9 foot storm surge. Now, keep in mind, this is an area that has 30-foot tides every single day. Because it's so far north, the action of the moon, the tidal action of the moon on the ocean, the tides are radical. You will see up to 30 feet of shift between high tide and low tide. So it's really, really drastic. To add 9 feet to that is something very severe. Arctic sea ice this year reached the second lowest coverage since satellite records began in 1979, according to the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. Scientists there on Tuesday were watching the Alaska storm and anticipating its impacts. He goes on to say, 40 years ago, a big storm like this would come through and the sea ice would act as a sort of buffer. The Bering Sea has and always will have these strong storms. It's some of the roughest seas in the world. What is different now is their potential destructiveness as you lose the sea ice cover. This storm is coming in quite early. Most of these storms come in late November, early December. This is a very early storm coming in where the water is fairly warm and the ice has really not had a chance to form. Federal, state, and local agencies were making emergency preparations in advance of the storm. The U.S. Coast Guard said it had staged helicopters in the region and sent a cutter to prepare for emergency responses with special forces on the crab fishing fleet. How would you like to be out there? You remember the Deadliest Catch episode where the storm came in. That was really a white-knuckle ride for those guys and for all the people that watched that program. Numerous government agencies have set up an incident command, said Jeremy Zidek, a spokesman for the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Nome, with 3,600 residents, is one of the largest cities in western Alaska. That's a big city in Alaska, 3,600 residents. The communities spread along the coastline are mostly traditional native settlements with a few hundred to a few thousand inhabitants and no road links between communities. That's it. You hike out or you ride a horse or a dog sled or a snowmobile or you fly. Although the region is sparsely populated, the storm presents significant dangers, Alaska Senator Mark Begich said. I realize we are in a remote part of the country, but many people and communities are in harm's way, Begich said in a statement. In the past, massive ozone loss over Antarctica has grabbed the headlines. But this year, measurements by several different sources show record levels of stratospheric ozone loss over the Arctic. Scientists say the main reason for the record ozone loss this year is that unusually cold stratospheric temperatures, which have endured later into the season than usual. This is exactly the kind of weather patterns that I was talking to you about all summer long. Scientists say the unusual loss is not catastrophic, but something that needs to be monitored. The World Meteorological Organization cautioned that people who live in northerly latitudes could get sunburned easier and watch out for those cataracts, noting that ozone-depleted air masses extended from the North Pole to southern Scandinavia. The main danger here is that very short-wave ultraviolet radiation makes its way through the atmosphere to the surface. Now, normally, eye damage occurs with people who live at very high altitudes, 14 to 18,000 feet, like in Tibet. The number one surgery that occurs in Tibet is cataract surgery, which is performed by a Swiss mission. So this is the kind of damage that occurs. It also kills much of the ground bacteria, which is responsible for breaking down a lot of the dead foliage in the ground, making nutrients and releasing methane into the atmosphere. The record low temperatures were caused by unusually strong winds known as the polar vortex, which isolated the atmospheric mass over the North Pole and prevented it from mixing with air in the mid-latitudes. Sound a little bit like the coming global superstorm? Sound a little bit like that book called by the same name by Art Bell I guess about 10, 12 years ago that came out. Sound a little bit like The Day After Tomorrow. Well, this has allowed for the formation of polar stratospheric clouds, and the catalytic chemical destruction of ozone molecules occurs on the surface of these clouds, which form at 18 to 25 kilometers high, when temperatures drop below minus 78 degrees Celsius. Minus 78 degrees Celsius. That's about 100 below Fahrenheit. People ask me all the time if the activities of mankind have an effect on climate change. I usually tell them no. But I must say that I'm thinking, like everyone else, when I consider CO2 and greenhouse gases. This created conditions similar to those that occur every southern hemisphere winter over the Antarctic. CO2 is one of those gases that's readily absorbed by algae in the ocean. So I wouldn't worry too much about CO2. It's a naturally occurring gas. It's something that is part of the respiration process of all life on the Earth that consumes oxygen. And fortunately, we have a plethora of plant life on the planet that converts CO2 into sugar and back into oxygen. So as the CO2 levels come up, the algae levels in the ocean comes up, and it offsets that by quite easily. Also, I would like to point out that volcanic explosions put a tremendous amount of CO2 into the atmosphere, along with other things, sulfur dioxides, nitrous oxides. And normally, the fauna, trees, plants, growing things, and algae take care of all that. One large volcanic eruption puts out more than all the cars in the world for several years. So don't worry about the CO2. That's kind of a political shell game that they're playing, trying to force more taxes globally. But the chlorofluorocarbons are real. And although there is a global ban, supposedly a global ban on chlorofluorocarbons, which we have used primarily as propellants and coolants, the propellants have been in everything from asthma inhalers to spray paint, and the coolants are the air conditioning systems that we've used since, the late 40s. We started out with ammonia as a coolant, and it was quite effective, but smelly. The first refrigerators had ammonia coolers on them, and when they got leaks, they would just run everybody out of the building. The new Freon ones were able to achieve 40 degrees pretty easily, which is the average temperature of your average refrigerator. And different chemistries were able to present freezing temperatures. We take a fraction of that off and cool the fridge and the rest of it to make the freezer. And then, of course, all the air conditioning in cars. Well, the problem was that as cheap as these chlorofluorocarbons were, and they were used because they have a very low boiling point, and they're easily made, cheaply made, and easily compressed, and it makes for a great heat transfer between the inside of your car and the outside atmosphere. Unfortunately, most of those systems never worried about capturing the CO2 or the chlorofluorocarbons if you've got a leak, Freon. If a hose leaked or if you needed a seal replaced or a compressor replaced, heck, they just let it out in the atmosphere. Well, you wouldn't think one or two would have a big problem, but this stuff was being made by the train load, and all of it was leaking into the atmosphere. Trouble was that we were sending high-altitude balloons up in the atmosphere, taking samples of the chemical makeup of the stratosphere, and guess what we found? You bet. Chlorofluorocarbons. And that, when it comes in contact with the ozone, barely needs any catalyst, and the ozone's gone. And it was literally consuming the ozone. Now, ozone is O3, three oxygen atoms put together, and it's a free radical. It has an extra electron on it, so it's extremely reactive. But up there in the stratosphere, the atmospheric pressure is very low. These molecules don't meet very often with anything, and so they're pretty stable until photons of ultraviolet light come through, in which they dimerize or react. But in doing so, they absorb that shortwave radiation, and we don't get it here on the Earth. Now, if you think about that for a moment, there are two things that I just mentioned that take out the ozone layer. One is chlorofluorocarbons, which we've made a global effort at stemming. I don't know if third world countries are going by that or not, but you cannot get the freon from any other source. So a lot of the source has been stemmed. The other source is ultraviolet radiation from the sun or from other sources in space. So either the planet is being bombarded with shortwave radiation from space, or we have chemicals that are reacting with the ozone layer up in the polar vortex. And that's why the ozone hole has been increased over the Arctic, which could be causing problems up there. All of this is being studied. It's all controversial. And the question is, how much does man contribute to all this? Well, he does. Our activities do contribute to it. Are we responsible for climate change? Most likely not. But climate change is most likely what has ended 97% of the extinctions, or caused 97% of the extinctions on this planet. Well over 90% of the species that ever lived on this planet are extinct, and they went extinct a long time before we ever discovered the first oil, and they were caused by climate change, one after the other after the other. Deserts or tropical areas became deserts, mountains became valleys, valleys became mountains. This earth has changed a lot in those periods of time. So what participation does man have in it? I would say, in my scientific opinion, less than 2%. But that being said, can climate change get to the point where 1% or 2% can make a difference? That's the real question that you want answered. Do you want to take a gamble that 1% or 2% won't make a difference? I would not. I would say that if we have the ability to grow our own energy, if we have the ability to live within the means of the planet to provide with to provide us with clean, renewable energy, I think we should take it. I, for one, regardless of the economy that it sets up, regardless of the addiction that we have, nation after nation, to this elixir of the earth, we should stop burning it. There are other uses for it. We can make plastic out of it. We can make coatings. We can make fibers. We can make dyes. We can make plastics. All kinds of stuff that we can make with this. Everything from clothing to medicine. We don't have to burn it. We can do other things. There are lots and lots of options. Yes, we might be trading one job for another, but that's called free enterprise. Stop subsidizing the big buggy whip companies, and it'll allow new technologies to come along just fine. So, the idea of ozone is a protective layer of atmosphere found at about 25 kilometers up there in the atmosphere. Very thin. Nobody lives up there. It acts like a sunlight filter, shielding life on Earth from harmful ultraviolet rays, which can increase the risk of skin cancer and cataracts in humans and harm marine life. It can also kill vital surface bacteria, which help rot away dead foliage and animal life in part of the cycle of life on our planet. You kill that bacteria, you've got a serious, serious problem. Stratospheric temperatures in the Arctic usually do vary widely from winter to winter. Last year, temperatures and ozone above the Arctic were very high. The last unusually low stratospheric temperatures over the North Pole were recorded in 1997. Oh, 1997. Were we in the throes of global warming then? Huh. That's pretty strange, isn't it, that we had record low stratospheric temperatures over the North Pole in 1997. Actually, global warming as a net gain in temperature of the Earth stopped in 1998 And then we started seeing a very slow increase in the wide swings between winter and summer. We are now in the widest swing between winter and summer in the northern and southern hemispheres than we have ever seen. The ozone depletion is not necessarily a big surprise, said Paul Newman, not the actor, an atmospheric scientist and ozone expert at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. The ozone layer remains vulnerable to large depletions because of total stratospheric chlorine levels that are still high in spite of the regulation of ozone depleting substances by the Montreal Protocol. That is, if you remember listening to the program 3 weeks ago, we talked about asthma inhalers losing the chlorofluorocarbons as a propellant, and now they're using a different kind of propellant, and people that are using the asthma spray are complaining that it actually locks them up instead of opening up their lungs. Anyway, chlorine levels are declining slowly because of ozone-depleting substances having extremely long lifetimes, so it will take a while to get rid of this stuff. Ozone holes do not form consistently over the North Pole like they do in Antarctica. Last winter, we had very high, lower stratospheric temperatures, and ozone levels were very high. This year is just the opposite. The real question is, why is this year so dynamically quiet and cold in the stratosphere? That's a big question with no good answer. Nobody predicted this. Nobody saw this coming. Scientists will be watching in the coming months for possible increases in the intensity of ultraviolet radiation in the Arctic and mid-latitudes. That would be Canada region, since ozone is Earth's natural sunscreen. We need to wait and see if this will actually happen, Newman said. It's something to look at, but it's not catastrophic. It's true. For humans, it's not that big a deal. We can wear sunglasses. We can wear long-sleeve shirts. We can survive. We can adapt, but nature cannot. Scientists are also investigating why the 2011 and 1997 Arctic winters were so cold, and whether these random events are statistically linked to global climate change. There you have it. In a changing climate, it is expected that on average, stratospheric temperatures cool, which means more chemical ozone depletion will occur, said Mark Weber from the University of Bremen. Experts say that on a global scale, the ozone layer is still on a long-term course for recovery because we've made the change. Mankind has made a change away from these chlorofluorocarbons. But for decades to come, there remains a risk of major ozone losses on yearly or regional scales. The Antarctic ozone hole forms when extremely cold conditions, common in the winter Antarctic stratosphere, trigger reactions that convert atmospheric chlorine from human-produced chemicals into forms that destroy the ozone. To investigate the 2011 Arctic ozone loss, scientists from 19 institutions in 9 countries, that's the U.S., Germany, the Netherlands, which is a vast array of cities and universities, Canada, Russia, Finland, Denmark, Japan, and Spain. They analyzed a comprehensive set of measurements using balloons, aircraft, different kinds of spectrometers. These included daily global measurements of trace gases and clouds from NASA's Aura and Calypso spacecraft, ozone measured by instrumented balloons, meteorological data, and atmospheric models. The scientists found that at some altitudes, the cold period in the Arctic lasted more than 30 days longer in 2010 than in any previous studied Arctic winter, leading to unprecedented ozone loss. Further studies are needed to determine what factors caused the cold period to last so long. And I would say that, you know, we can speculate all day long on this, but we have already talked about these massive wide swings in temperature between the summers and the winters. And now we've already seen that we haven't even gotten into the winter of 2011 yet, And we're already seeing 30 days longer of this cold period in the Arctic than any previous studied Arctic winter. So, you know, this is the danger that we face, that these wide swings are having an effect on nature. The life forms that can survive it, we've already seen an entire wheat crop lost in Russia. We have seen Texas literally on fire for an entire summer. We have seen drought. We've seen summers that disappeared for the last two winters in a row. Two summers in a row. There's been no summer in the West. In Utah, in Colorado, in Idaho, in Wyoming, there's been no summer. We had cool temperatures all summer long. Recently, it snowed on top of last winter's snow in the Wasatch Front in Salt Lake, up above the mountains in Salt Lake. They had a 500% snowpack last winter, and that was snowed on this year. They were skiing on July 4th. At Snowbird, and they're going to be skiing this week at Snowbird. So now you know what I'm talking about. This is climate change. I was up in those mountains just a little over a year and a half ago, and it was gorgeous. It was short sleeve weather. You could see across the mountaintops from the top of those mountains, up around 10,000 feet, and no snow anywhere to be found. I mean, nothing but trees and dirt. And now it's all covered with snow from last year. These chemical reactions that produce ozone-destructive chlorine compounds occur on the surfaces of cold polar stratospheric cloud and aerosol particles, said Lamont Poole, a co-author of the paper, and a scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. And these particles were abundant in the Arctic until mid-March of 2011. Much later than usual, with average amounts at some altitudes similar to those observed in the Antarctic and dramatically larger than the near-zero values seen in March in most Arctic winters, Poole said. The 2011 Arctic ozone loss occurred over an area considerably smaller than that of the Antarctic ozone holes. This is because the Arctic polar vortex, a persistent large-scale cyclone, within which the ozone loss takes place, was about 40% smaller than a typical Antarctic vortex. While smaller and shorter lived than its Antarctic counterpart, the Arctic polar vortex is more mobile, often moving over densely populated northern regions. Decreases in overhead ozone led to increases in surface ultraviolet radiation, which are known to have adverse effect on humans and other life forms. You really don't want a lot of blind polar bears and seals. It's not what nature intended. So I know that some of you out there have opinions on climate change. Some believe that it does exist. Some believe that it doesn't exist. I guess it depends on which news program you listen to. But if you listen to X Squared Radio, you have all the facts. You can make up your own mind. I can tell you that the evidence is what I consider irrefutable, that climate change is upon us. this is not something that's going to normalize very quickly. Hang on one moment. Just a little fruit punch to help soothe the voice here. Still getting over the plague, like many of you. One of the things that we monitor around the world, and we get emails from it from time to time, and finally a news story has come out about it. And I'm interested in the emails because a lot of these are sort of independent scientists. They have a fair amount of equipment. Some of it, you know, you can buy off the shelf, but the idea that they have invested in this equipment and that they possess it and use it is encouraging, and what we get the emails on is radiation. Since Fukushima, The world has been getting a slow dose of cesium-137 along with other nuclides that are coming from the Fukushima area. Now, you could say what you want about this, and we've covered this in some detail because of the great work that's been done by others of how terrible this tragedy is, and it continues to be. But the idea that we could have one large nuclear event, which would give us a very acute spike in radiation, is not really as life-threatening on a long-term basis as a slow and chronic exposure to radiation. Many of my colleagues out there who have sent me information, some of them a little off the grid, but nevertheless credible in my my mind because of their scientific methods, have alerted the world to the fact that this chronic exposure is actually more life-threatening in terms of increasing leukemia, different kinds of cancers, and other health problems because of a long, slow, chronic exposure that is spreading around the world. Well, that being said, now there's an article, Strange Radiation in Europe. Very low levels of radiation, which are higher than normal, but don't seem to pose a health hazard. I love the way these articles put this. No, it doesn't pose a health hazard this year, but chronic exposure, you know, this is cumulative. You don't just flush it out of your system by going out Thursday night and downing a bunch of adult beverages. It sticks with you. And over the years, it adds up in your tissues. And then 5 years, 8 years down the road, you see a 10, 20, 30% increase in cancer. That's where the health hazard comes from. So when they say, oh, well, the rates are 100 times higher than normal, but, you know, normal is, you know, just very, very, very small. We're talking about, you know, micro rads. Well, over a period of time, that stuff adds up. Anyway, these low levels of radiation are being registered in the Czech Republic and elsewhere in Europe. The International Atomic Energy Agency said Friday, just a couple of days ago. The agency said the cause was not known. The cause was not known, but was not the result of Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, which spread radiation across the globe in March. Very interesting. The very low levels of iodine-131 have been measured in the atmosphere, the agency said in a statement. It said such radioisotope will lose much of its radiation in about 8 days. It's true. So if it has a half-life of about, it has a half-life of about 12 and a half days, actually, where's it coming from? If they're seeing it in Europe, it means it had to travel there in about 4 days in order to be detected. It's a little bit like radon. You know, radon is a big cause of cancer. When you build your house over in an area where radon, which is a very small particle that migrates to the surface, it's a daughter of uranium, and it has a very short half-life. If you're ingesting it, it means that you live in a very geologically porous area and or the uranium source is fairly close to the surface. That means that it has not much time to decay off of its parent nuclide, make its way to the surface, be ingested, and then decay. And, of course, when it decays, it's an alpha decay, which is a large particle decay, and has a very high incidence of collision with healthy tissue, thus causing cancer. So that's the nature of this isotope. However, an official familiar with the matter who asked for anonymity because he was not authorized to comment, we are here at X Squared Radio, nothing is classified. So if you give us information, you can bank that it's going to be broadcasted. Anyway, he said the release appeared to be continuing. The agency said that it was investigating. Oh, yeah, they're going to track it down because this stuff has a radioactive signature that literally it can be traced right to the reactor that it comes from. So not to worry, they will find it. The Czechs are betting heavily on nuclear power and have plans to dramatically increase production, a move that would give the country a place among Europe's most nuclear-dependent nations. They currently rely on 6 nuclear reactors for 33% of their total electricity. The government hopes to at least double that output. There, that's in a stark contrast to its neighbors. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's government decided to phase out nuclear energy by 2022, following the meltdown at the Fukushima plants and other things as well. And Switzerland has followed suit. Austria abandoned nuclear energy after the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster and strictly opposes the Czech nuclear program. It does have some inherent problems, I will say that. Now, we've had nuclear power plants active and running since the early 60s in this country. And I have to say, you know, I visited San Onofre in Southern California in 1964, I think. And I have visited the Fukushima site in 2001. So, you know, we've been around, we've visited, and it seems to be a pretty safe operation all in all. They do a pretty good job of containing things. I'm surprised, though, that Fukushima built in such a tectonically active area and San Onofre basically smack dab on top of the San Andreas Fault. But they, you know, they're very safe. And I've got to tell you that we did a long special on the Fukushima plant. And the containment that was at the Fukushima plant was totally capable of containing any kind of natural explosion that could occur at that plant. We told you what caused the containment to come apart there, and it definitely was not a hydrogen explosion. We also revealed to you that reactor number 4, which is the one you saw blow up on camera when the news cameras were filming it, wasn't even online. It didn't even have any fuel in it. So that's one of the reasons why the report, which was released yesterday, was 75% blacked out. If you don't believe me, you can watch the news yourself. The Fukushima manual that was released to the public yesterday was 75% blacked out. That is to say, they used a black highlighter. You look at the pages and every single table, every single figure, every single line on almost every single page has been blacked out. None of that information has been shared. The reason is they know where it's going to lead. If you see that information, you read it for yourself, you will see Fukushima was not hit by any 9.1 quake. It might have been a 5.6 quake, maybe a 6.0. Been through one myself. I know what they look like. Now, what took that plant down was something completely different. And if you need to go back and listen to that episode of X Squared Radio, I highly suggest that you do so because there's evidence there and you can look it up for yourself. The news is out there if you want to find it. All right, I said that I would mention this at the end of this hour. I'm going to remind you that the phone lines are open, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us, 530-413-4511, 530-413-4511. And I highly recommend that you get your Christmas shopping out of the way before Thanksgiving because the pickings are going to be slim. So get out there. If you have to put it on layaway, put it on layaway. But get your Christmas shopping done before Thanksgiving. When doing so, make sure to dial into the BBS radio conference line, 760-569-7676. Put in the passcode 192919. Put that in your text. And don't forget to add the pound after that, 192919. 919 pound, and then you can listen to the program on your cell phone. Lots of people do. And you can always Skype me at X2-Radio during the program. I take your notes. That's one of the things we're going to cover right now. Somebody's asked me about my opinion on the Sandusky affair at Penn State. Those of you that know me very well know I was a scoutmaster for 6 years. I know there's only one place to get men of good character, and that's from boys of good character. And the best place to build boys of good character is the Boy Scouts of America, because a scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. And all boys, you know, are all out. They're all in all the time. I tend to look at life through the eyes of a boy most of the time. I have fun at pretty much everything I do, but this is serious. Mr. Sandusky and his victimization of children is absolutely unacceptable. It was unacceptable the day that it happened, and all you really have to do is look at life through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy, and you'll have exactly the same viewpoint that I do. I, for one, think the guy should be let free after he gives us the names of all the rich donors that he pimped 10-year-old boys to. Give us the name of the donors that gave money to the school in exchange for your activities. You give us those names, and you, Mr. Sandusky, can go free. You'll be just fine. All right, that's all I'm going to say about that. Anybody have any opinions on it, you can call me here, 888-429-5471. A couple words on the Occupy movement. Some people have been asking me about the sociology of that. Studying it from a scientific point of view, I think that protest occurs for protest's sake. It does. It can get a little anarchy to it, which I'm sure there's a flavor of that in almost any protest movement. There was in the Tea Party movement, fortunately. There were strong leaders and strong speakers and strong political personalities that were involved in the Tea Party movement that started the Tea Party movement. We had Sarah Palin, and we had Michelle Bachmann, and we had others that were heavily involved in it. We had libertarian members out there, Ron Paul, who had been saying the same thing for years and years, which 10 years ago was radical. 5 years ago was maybe a little not mainstream, but today it seems to be right down the middle of the alley of the mainstream. The strange thing is that the press, including CBS last night, only gave him 89 seconds to speak. 89 seconds to a person that has 12% of the vote. It was beyond me. But, no complaints. He has a strong online and social network contingent that will make themselves known in time. That being said, the Occupy movement, just the name Occupy, smacks of the proletariat movement of early fascism. I know it sounds strange to even use that word, but this is how it came about, folks. If you read your history books, you'll see that the smart leaders, the smart people that didn't have money, and they had a very radical, let's throw the bums out kind of attitude. Not in the sense of, making an election out of it. In the sense of becoming thugs and going in and literally throwing them out of their own banks and taking over. It's happened twice. If you really want to know what the Occupy movement is like, go back and read a book on the rise of Mussolini. Go back and read a book on the rise of Adolf Hitler, and you will see how these Occupy movements work. Now, these aren't protests within the Constitution of the United States. Far from it. These are protests to tear the Constitution of the United States apart. This movement is dedicated toward taking the wealth of a nation and carving it up and giving them their fair share for nothing, just for breathing air. They're not productive. They'll never be productive. So this is the non-productive, something-for-nothing crowd that is coming out and protesting, saying, capitalism doesn't work for me. I'm sure you've heard that very same line over and over and over again as they stick the microphone in front of the random person on the sidewalk. Capitalism doesn't work for me. What that means is I don't work, so I don't get paid. And that doesn't work for me. I want to get paid even though I don't work. Because I can guarantee you that every single person in this country that makes more than $100,000 a year, every one of them, every one of them, works at least 80 to 100 hours a week. There's no Saturdays. There's no Sundays for them. There's no nighttime. You sleep in between tasks. That's how dedicated they are to doing what they do. And if they sleep in, if they decide to take a vacation, they're losing money. And if they ever stop buying stuff, you really will be in trouble. Because they buy the stuff that you build. So, what happens in economic science is not that all the gold is gone. There never was any to begin with, people. It's all alchemy. It's all fake. The value was created out of nothing. Yes, it was based on gold at first, but then the gold was given away. The gold went away. Then it was based on paper, which represented the gold. It was loaded with alchemical and Freemason symbolism, and we bought it. And now it's based on ones and zeros. And just like any drug addict or any alcoholic that gets used to the buzz, they go deeper and deeper into the addiction. The Fed is addicted to cash. And they just create it. They just open the file, add some zeros, and hit enter. They create it out of nothing. Just a few more ones and zeros. There is no value to it. The stock market is completely valueless. It's not based on earnings. It's not based on the value in those companies. It's only based on a bunch of microscopic trades between computers. It's a game. All they're doing is trading monopoly money back and forth, hundreds of trades a month, just to keep rising it up or pushing it down, whichever they want to do in order to make more money. But it's valueless. There's nothing to it. What happened to the economy? The economy stopped moving. It was like a giant a giant carousel. Money got on, it moved around the cycle, got spent 10 or 11 times, and got off. Somewhere in the middle of that wheel, the money stopped moving. And when the money stopped moving, the rest of the carousel fell apart like dominoes. The payment just kept coming around and smacking up against the empty wallet. And what happened was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of homes got put on the market because the mortgage payments weren't being made because the money stopped moving. That's what happened. That's all that happened. There never was any value. It was all fake. What has to happen is the wheel has to get moving again. In order to get the wheel moving again, someone has to put money in the system. And I don't mean just creating ones and zeros. I mean stopping the consumption of all the cash in the United States of America by the United States government. And I don't mean cutting back on national defense. I don't mean cutting back on entitlements. I don't even mean cutting back on national assistance or foreign aid. I mean cutting back on government. Take the Department of Energy apart. Take the Department of Education apart. Take the Department of Interior apart, the Commerce Department, the International Trade Administration. Take the Department of Education apart. Gut them. Everything they do adds no value to the system at all. Now, there are some basic offices that probably need to stay in those, but we need to lay off about 375,000 federal workers, and I don't mean soldiers. That's the way Clinton did it. I mean federal workers laid off now. That's the way any corporation would do it, and that's the way this corporation needs to do it. You lay them off, put them in the soup line, and get the money back in the system and allow small business to pull our butts out of the mud. Let's see what our callers have to say about it. Diane, welcome to the program.
How are you, Brooks?
I'm really good. Thanks.
I just want to call and make a comment on Occupy Detroit, which I've been a part of now for the past 2 months.
Oh, tell me everything. I want to know from the inside.
Well, I've been cooking for him. I have been cooking for many years for the less fortunate, the elderly. And I decided I wanted to get a part of Occupy. And I believe much of the media is misinformed about what is going on with Occupy the world. These people are a diversified people. Absolutely. But they are all about what they believe is what is right and constitutionally right. And they want to know more about the Constitution, absolutely, as far as my experience has been. And I have been down there now for the past several weeks. In fact, I even got a parking ticket for unloading my food, okay, which was totally free, with no expense to anybody, and the Detroit Police Department gave me a parking ticket for unloading free food. However, I think that much of the media is misinformed. Without actually being down there, they're just parroting what they've heard rather than being a part of the experience.
Well, I'm pretty sure that they're sticking the microphone in front of people they want to so that they get this crazy, you know, hey, we want to take all the money from the rich and give it to the poor. Gee whiz.
No, that's not it at all. That's not it at all. Most of these kids and young adults and elderlies, as far as Vietnam War veterans and people in wheelchairs and so forth and so on, they have seen the corruption in the system. And the young kids know they have no future. They know that they have a $150,000 bill at 9 to 11% interest rate for their college education, that they can't find a job, and they can't pay the loan.
Well, but why blame the nation that they can't find a job? Why are they blaming Wall Street that they can't get a job?
Let me say this to you. I'm in Detroit, Michigan, and there isn't a job to be had.
Oh, I know. I mean, I've been doing business with Detroit since 1982. I just got back from there a couple of weeks ago. I went up to the University of Michigan and spoke. I know all about the lack of jobs, but that's because people are not out there buying cars. And the reason they're not buying cars is because they don't have jobs. And the reason they don't have jobs is because the small businesses, which would line up from here to L.A., if there were Small Business Administration loans being given out, they could start these businesses and hire people. But the money is all being given by the government to large multi-billion dollar multinational companies, which are making large campaign donations.
Well, it's all part of the plan.
They need to march on Washington, not Detroit.
Well, you know what? You know what, Brooks? I've been in Washington with thousands of people. The ignorance, they have no – I don't know what the answer is, but I have been in Washington numerous times in busloads of people back to the Million Mom March. Remember the Million Mom March against Rosie O'Donnell and the Second Amendment?
I was there.
Okay, and I can tell you something. That doesn't hold anything. It doesn't hold any water at all. I mean, they claim that there was 100,000, a million moms with Rosie O'Donnell. We had 6,000 people, all right, there that was against Rosie O'Donnell for the Second Amendment. All right, and you know what? We got no press at all. As a matter of fact, my husband called me at the hotel room that night, all right, that I was there. He said, what did you do? Did you change your position? And I said, absolutely not. He said, well, I saw you. I saw your flag. I saw your – they photoed the back of our protest marching right down to the Capitol. They photographed and said on the media that was the Million Mom March when it wasn't.
Wow.
When it wasn't. It was us protecting the Second Amendment. It was not Rosie O'Donnell, but the news across the nation said that was Rosie O'Donnell. She didn't have a million women there. There's no way in hell. I was there.
Well, now we have social media. We can set all that straight moment by moment using Twitter and Facebook.
Well, I'm concerned about the Occupy the World. Because you know what? These people, I was in Egypt. I was in Egypt January with William Henry. Okay, when we got locked down. Okay, and I was there for 4 extra days because I couldn't fly out. I watched what was happening there. I was downtown. And I couldn't get a flight out. And I watched those people. And that's where it started in 2011. Even though it's been going on for many years. But for right now, and that's what really fired the Occupy movement.
Sure, absolutely. And
the Occupy movement is not anti-capitalist. You know what it is? It's more ignorance. These people do not know, but they know that something is very seriously wrong.
Of course. What they need is a unified message. I don't know if they need a leader. I think they enjoy being leaderless.
They need a leader. They need a leader like Ron Paul. They need a leader that somebody is going – and you know what? Most of them are for Ron Paul. Most of them are for Ron Paul. I've talked to hundreds of them. And most of them are, but you know what? They all believe that the voting system is corrupt. And even if they put their vote, if they take their time to put their vote to the ticket, that it's not going to make a difference because the corruption is going to put in place what they want to put in place. And
I don't think it'll make that.
And there is going
happen.
To be a huge revolution.
If we're talking 1 or 2%, you're probably right. They could fake it and they could push it. But if the Occupy movement wants to pick a candidate like Ron Paul and support him, I can guarantee you he's not going to endorse them. And the reason he's not, because it's political suicide to align yourself with Occupy. It just is. But if they will back him because of his ideology and they will vote for him, he will win. He's already won a bunch of straw polls. And when these election results start coming out, you'll see Ron Paul has got the stick-to-itiveness. When they only give him about 90 seconds to speak.
Excuse me, Brooks, but he's won most all the straw polls. He gets no recognition. And you know what? The Occupy movement, as far as what I can tell, it only in Detroit, because that's the only experience I've had, that they know that he has been slandered and he has gotten no recognition. All right, but what they want to see is not the change of America like Obama wants. I mean that change is shoot that out the back door, because that change has really been a devastation to this country.
It really has.
I mean there's no change there. Oh, there's change. There's change, and it only puts a hammer and the sickle and the hammer. Like the communist, all right?
I support that statement because they want the freedom. You know that I've been to Washington many, many times on behalf of small business, and we have been completely shut out of any of the aid. No loans, no grants. know nothing. In fact, yep, there's absolutely. A little box when you go to apply for a grant. It says you're a small business, you're a veteran-owned business, you're a disadvantaged small business. If you check that box, your application is scraped right into the trash.
Oh, absolutely. I talked to all these kids down there that have graduated 4 and 6 years of college that owe $150,000 to $250,000 at anywhere between 9 and 11% interest from our federal government. They can't find a job, and there's no way to pay it back.
Yeah, but what did they get their degrees in? History? Geography?
You know, it varies. It varies. It doesn't matter what the degrees are in. They were offered, and they had no idea. They were absolutely clueless, totally ignorant, okay, on what these grants – there weren't grants. Grant is something that's given for free.
Right.
These were loans.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Student
the grant,
loans.
A Pell Grant won't get you through college. It'll take away a little bit of the sting.
No, but one graduate had
about $45,000 in loans.
Loans.
But it was at about 4%, and I paid it all back.
But that wasn't like, you know what? It wasn't what it was back 25, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. The government has literally raped these kids. And they have no way, at least in Detroit. I can only speak for Detroit. But I can assume that this is happening all over the country, and that's why Occupy is growing and growing and growing. And wait till you see what happens in the spring. They might be low level right now because of the winter, because of the cold and everything, and you know, switching areas like Oakland, what they did in Oakland, California. But I'm going to tell you something. This is a growing giant. This is a sleeping lion. And it's awakening.
I just hope they can avoid altercation with the police because you know what?
The police are going to join in. I'm going to tell you, I've talked to the police. Even though they gave me a ticket, I talked to them. And they in Detroit, they have gotten no confrontation from the police whatsoever. No confrontation from the police. Oh, okay. We can't. Okay, in Detroit, we cannot use a blowhorn. We cannot use a microphone. Everything is done, and just like you've seen on YouTube, everything is done where one person announces it, and it's just repeated throughout the crowd. And when they can't clap, it's against the law to clap.
Really?
So they have to take their hands and wave them like yada yada yada.
Well, I'll tell you, I would be happy.
I just had to share that with you, Brooks, because you know what? Everyone in America should join the Occupy group because that is who we are.
Well, let me tell you, Diane, stand up for who we are and what we are
and the rights that we have. And if we continue to let this bureaucracy take us over, that's the end.
Diane, let me do this. I will do this because it's X Squared Radio and it's my program and I can do what I want. I will make a space next Sunday and every Sunday after that, if that's what it takes. You get one or two of your Occupy people. They can come on anonymously if they want to. And let them make their case. Now, I'm not going to debate with them, but I will ask them questions that will get their ideology out.
That would be great.
If I can give them airtime, you know, they'll have 20,000 or 30,000 people live and a couple million people in a week that will hear what they say. So make sure that you pick people that know what their message is.
Absolutely.
And I won't make a fool out of them. That's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to hear their story. So if you want them to come on next Sunday night, I would be happy to interview them. They can call from your house or whatever, and we can just talk to them by phone for 5 or 10 minutes, and that will be great. Then it'll be on tape or on digital recorder, and then it'll be out there for the world to hear.
I really appreciate that. That would be great because I only am a bystander. I went down there to feed them, but I listened to them. I listen to the hearts of these people and these young kids and the Vietnam veterans, the ones in wheelchairs with no legs, no arms. I listen to these people. And I want to tell you something, Brooks. And you and I've met each other personally. I'm not pulling any brag on you. I'm telling you that these people are sincere, and they are going to freeze to death over what they believe. That's how sincere that they are.
Well, you bring the heart to the radio, and I'll give them the voice.
I thank you very much for that, and have a good evening, and I will talk to you next Sunday with another voice for Occupy Detroit.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much. And by the way, I have an open invitation to Ron Paul to come on the program as well. And I have spoken to his son, Rand, and I haven't got him to come on the program yet, but I have spoken to him, and we're getting there. We're getting there.
Questing him. But if I can do anything, I don't have any real connections with him. I know him personally, but I don't know if I have any influence. But I definitely will email or pass on that message.
All right. I appreciate you, Diane. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening.
You too. All right. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. We ran long, about 15 minutes, but you know what? That's okay. We don't have any hard breaks here, but I need one so I can drink a little bit more fruit juice. So we'll be right back. Don't go away. Be back with more X Squared Radio after this. Now, there you have it, a little uprising muse off their album, The Resistance. Just thought it was fitting. Hopefully we can give a voice, a real voice, to some of the more eloquent, intelligent, and ideological aspects of the Occupy movement here on X Squared Radio. We're all about getting the truth out there, and that's what we're trying to do here. So I hope you don't mind, but we're going to give a little voice to it. All right, right now, let's get back into X Squared Radio stuff. Keep the stuff coming via Skype, too. I really appreciate it. I will continue to answer your questions if you don't want to come on the air with your voice. If you do, it's 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America, toll free. If you can get to a cell phone tower anywhere on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. And we always appreciate the conference call listeners at 760-569-7676. They use the passcode 192919 pound. This hour, I want to talk about the eternal self. Call it a biological transducer with an ethereal mind. Because after all, we are eternal beings having a mortal experience. And I'd be happy to take your phone calls about any of this stuff, especially the Occupy movement, because, you know, they're really not getting a voice out there, and the voice that they are getting, I think, is skewed, and they're baiting them, some of the less eloquent, less well-spoken people to come. They stab a microphone in their face and say, yeah, we want all debts forgiven, we want the credit bureau done away with. Silly stuff, but I know that there's an ideology out there. There has to be no protest for protest's sake. I mean, that'll work okay for a while, a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, something like that. But, you know, you heard Diane. I was in Egypt just before overthrow of Mubarak took place, and it was a peaceful, peaceful movement. I met the people. I talked to them. Diane was there. She was there a little bit after I was. She got stuck. Couldn't get a flight out, so she did what she always does. She goes down on the street and talks to people and listens to them. And, you know, what we heard on the press was not what was going on in Cairo, I can tell you that. And what is going on in Detroit is not what the press is representing to us. Diane's the one taking them free food. She's baking it and cooking it and taking it down there and giving it to them for free. Because why? Because this kind of movement is what this nation is founded upon. We always take to the streets with our signs and our protests. But the news media is across the board really showing the worst foot forward for a lot of these people. Of course, they're predicting clashes with the police, and I know how clashes with the police occur. The police come out and clash with you. They put on the riot gear and the batons and the blood-borne pathogen gloves and the helmets and the shields and the boots, and they form a lockstep line, and they dare you to cross it. They dare you to cross it. You go out there with your mittens and your little down jacket and your stocking cap, and you're going to get your skull crushed, and it's going to change your life forever. You think these 24 people clogging up the court systems, you think they'll ever get a job? Maybe. But you commit a second or a third or even a first-degree misdemeanor, and it's going to be on your record for life. So think about that if you think about clashing with the police. There's a way to do this. There is a way to do this and be smart and be global with it. But you got to have a message, and you got to have a leader. You got to have somebody that they can stick a microphone in front of their face that will speak for the Occupy movement. You must have a creed. I don't mean a manifesto. I don't mean you need to go back and pull out Karl Marx and read it. Why don't you start with the Constitution? Why don't you start with that? It's a great document. Get it, learn it, and use it. It'll go far for you. All right. The eternal self, a biological transducer with an ethereal mind. The mind-body problem. Oh, my gosh. This is so big. We could spend hours and hours and hours on this, and I would really appreciate your phone calls on this because this is a deep subject, and I know you've been thinking about it. If you haven't been thinking about it lately, I know you have thought about it or you're going to think about it. So let's get into it. By the way, I wrote a note to my good friend Gary Schwartz, you know, author of The God Experiment. He did a big study with John Edwards, you know, John Edwards, the psychic on TV. He's for real. He's for real. His gift is for real. I put a poignant question to him, which I will share with you about halfway through this hour. But Dr. Schwartz was going to do a study to follow up on that question, which came up, I'm going to say a couple of years ago when I had him on the program. We talked about this, and it wasn't a hole in the research. No, not by any means. It was an opportunity presented by the research that may have been missed, but and it may not have been a subject or a portion of their study, but it made an opening that I posed the question. I posed a hypothesis, and supposedly over the last couple of years he's been gathering data, doing an experiment, and we'd like to know the results of that, or at least the progress on it so far. So I wrote him, and Dr. Schwartz will always write back, and he'll probably let me know if he's ready to make a report. But here we go. The mind-body problem has traditionally been framed as a conundrum concerning the relation between two seemingly incompatible substances. We wrote about this in our book, The Ark of Millions of Years, all four volumes, over 2,000 pages. The difference or the incompatibility and yet the absolute appearance of temporal and spiritual matter coming together. Indeed, the elusive nature of consciousness itself certainly does not render it a good candidate for reduction to a physical basis. Excuse me, I gotta clear my throat. When we look into the mirror, there is a moment of disbelief, and it really doesn't matter what our age is. The physical shape staring back at us is rarely better than what we expect. Between the limits of gravity and the aging process, there is a dichotomy of reality that nears impossibility. How could such a leaping, flying gazelle of a being be locked inside a body that can scarcely jump more than 12 inches off the ground? No matter how we shape our hand or change our thoughts, we cannot make the pair of sunglasses swirl in the space above the table like some agreement between ABS plastic and the will of our gently wafting fingers. Telekinesis, as try as we may, we can't do it. I mean, if you can, I'd appreciate you calling in, 888-429-5471. If you can levitate, by all means, 888-429-5471. But most of us cannot. We can't make a kernel of popcorn rise out of the bag and fall into my mouth at the theater. I wouldn't tell. I wouldn't tell anyone. I just want to do it, just one time. One time. Noting that physical theories alone would be incompatible with the absence of consciousness, popular philosophical arguments have long highlighted the fact that an adequate theory of consciousness requires more than mere brain physics can provide. In short, there is something more to our minds than meets the eye in brain imagery. There is more to it than the mere biochemistry can explain. It isn't a matter of hormones or electrochemical reactions that form consciousness. In opposition to the great Sir Roger Penrose, I have stated that consciousness is the source of quantum gravity and not the other way around. Today, advances in our knowledge of the underlying physics of consciousness seem to point to an entirely new paradigm based on a renewed view of mind-brain interactions. Various considerations derived from research in quantum physics and brain dynamics, the immune system, cognitive behavior therapy, and neuroplasticity suggest that the mind-body connections do in fact work both ways, and that in important respects the mind, by re-gearing attention and emotion, can effectively shape or rewire the brain, thus substantially affecting one's mental and physical health. We know for a clinical fact that genetic products of the human body are influenced by the environment. We also know by an even greater plethora of evidence that human consciousness of the being's self and that of the beings around the self makes up a significant part of that environment. The consciousness of your own and the consciousness of the people around you make up a great part of that environment. We can change that environment consciously, and as we most assuredly do it unconsciously. Of course, we'd like to do it consciously, but most of us wander through life like a deer in the headlights. We go through our lives reacting to the universe rather than acting upon it. The issues investigated by physicists, physicians, and neuroscientists raise a spectrum of profound questions, such as that of the compatibility of free will and moral action with the scientific view of the world. More generally, they lead us to ask and examine in what sense the knowledge and practice of mind-body connections suggested by these new insights can affect our sense of selfhood and agency, as well as shed new light on our understanding of the practical implications of various disciplines of attention, such as meditation, self-suggestion, and ethical awareness. You see how these can have great effects on your consciousness? If you consider these, and by consider, I mean meditate on them, think on them, write about them, sing about them, write poetry about them, envision them, experiment with them, share your thoughts with one another without fear, perhaps in love, you'll see that there are practical implications of these disciplines in affecting consciousness, the most important of which are selfhood and agency. You know, the grand difference between a human and an angel is agency. That's right. It's desire. Angels have no desire. Angels make no choices. They follow orders. They don't have free agency. They fulfill the measure of their creation by doing exactly what they're told, whether it's to impregnate a young woman or whether it's to wipe out 185,000 people in one night. They don't blink. They don't say, is this the right thing to do? They don't question. They just do. Humans, on the other hand, would say, but what if she's ugly? Or they might say, are you sure? 185,000, all of them? I mean, what if there are some good people out there? You see, we have agency. We have desire. We decide on our own because we're self-aware. We're not perfect soldiers. We're humans. We have consciousness. We make choices. Not something angels are allowed to do. If they do, they're cast out. As explorations into the neuropsychology of religious and spiritual experience provide new insights into the neural mechanisms underlying the interplay of consciousness, volition, emotion, the central question remains, to what extent does the mind transcend its neural basis? In other words, you have this gray matter up in your head that sloshes around and supposedly contains all of your memories and thoughts and abilities. But then there's the mind. There's the thing that does the thinking, that does the imagining, that does the stitching together of the pieces to make the patterns, to create the emotions, to deal with the emotions, to deal with the emotions of others, to put intention into the universe. That's not done with the brain. That's not done with the neural basis of the biological transducer. Far from it. It's done with the mind. So to what extent does the mind transcend that gray matter inside your skull? Conventional wisdom holds that assemblies of neurons must account for consciousness, and by extension for all subjective facets of lived experience. Yet, current research in the neural correlates of deep meditative states, out of body and near-death experiences, and the way in which spiritual beliefs influence health outcomes, allow us to frame the problem afresh by sidestepping the philosophical traps of the mind-body problem. If I want to put that in simpler terms, I would say it's pretty easy for a neuroscientist, a neurologist, to say, well, you know, emotional states are just a balance between serotonin and, you know, various hormones. And we know people that have criminal activity or criminal propensities have this gene in their gene code. And we know that children that are raised in this kind of environment, you know, we see this. We see the results of starvation. We see the results of drug abuse and alcoholism. You know, these are the kinds of things that neurologically we would hang our hat on. But when we consider, and this really throws a wrench in the works of the neural correlates, when we consider deep meditative states, and these can come on very suddenly, you can have been meditating your whole life and be doing the mechanics of it right and never really have this experience until now. You could do it one time, your first time, and have it change your life. Most people do. Why? Because they become more self-aware. They see themselves. They see their higher selves. They meet their intention head on, and they realize that that they need to make a change. Or they go to a clearing practitioner, and they move away all of the reflectors, the mirrors, the scripts that have been trapping them over and over and over again as they go through their business or social lives. They move those out of the way, and then they can become successful at love, at money, other things. This has nothing to do with the chemicals in the brain. This has nothing to do with the neural synapses and the chemical balances between hormones and proteins in the brain. Far from it. Out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences are irrefutable. The clinical evidence is so plethoric, it blows the mind of the classic neurologist. You have to understand that spiritual beliefs and intention influences health outcomes. In other words, doubling up on the placebo really does work. It does cure disease. The study of daydreaming and what I call micro-astral travel, this means you don't have to lay down for hours and go astrally travel to Venus or another world. This can be done in a split second. It can be done in a meeting. Don't do it while you're driving. You could do it as a passenger, but don't do it while you're driving. I've tried it. It's dangerous. You're going to have your rubber in the grass before you know it. Okay? I'm not talking about serious daydreaming, staring out the window like the teacher lecturing for hours and you don't remember a word he says. I'm talking about micro-astral travel, a brand new and budding field of study. We're going to talk a little bit about it, but I just named it, so it's going to be a while before we figure out what it is. But these are 1 second to 15 second out-of-body experiences where you're literally seeing another dimension, another time. You know, you're on the beach, or you're in the mountains, you're, you know, fishing, you're making love, whatever. You're having this micro-astral travel experience. Anyway, this is opening the possibility that we can experience life on many simultaneous levels, and that we can learn to balance these levels to offer rich perspective and full stereophonic sound to the sometimes two-dimensional hologram of everyday life. This is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about filling the physical time of your life, an hour, a moment, with something more than just warming your bicycle seat. I'm talking about the high of being alive on multiple levels, of sensing life on multiple levels at the same time. In the sense of a transcendent reality, merely an illusion caused by brainstorms or biochemical redox reactions, or is it indeed the very notion of transcendence that is capable of affecting brain activity? Just thinking about it causes your brain to react like pure oxygen poured on a sponge of alcohol that's been lit on fire. It turns into a rocket. It turns into a blazing fire of ideas, of passion. Are we capable of resolving suffering and scarcity while we are settling into our meditative pillow or turning the music up a little in our cars? While the debate continues, recent scientific investigations into mystic experience have compelled us to modify in important respects our view of the nature of the self and, more generally, of consciousness and lived experience. And you can live it once, and then you can go back and live it again from a different point of view, from a lesson learned, from a new perspective, from an absence of fear. That wasn't so bad, was it? Full of love. Wow, that was the neatest thing I've ever seen. Really? Tell me you don't go back and live that experience again, just in that moment. Yeah, that was kind of cool, wasn't it? In fact, that was really cool. I don't think I'll ever do it again, but that's now a treasure of my life. One striking conclusion derived from research into the neuronal underpinning of such experiences is that their correlation with brain activity is remarkably consistent across various cultures and faiths, thereby suggesting universal patterns of spiritual and moral experience, a kind of common core belonging to humanity as such. Now, if there's not a common core, then there is a common teacher or master, or perhaps, and this goes way out on the fringe, or perhaps genetic memory that is part of the design of our DNA. The consideration is whether we are the bird ready to leap into a new dimension with a pure knowledge that we can one day fly, or we are the lemming, ready to run off the cliff just because everyone else is doing it. One is a metamorphosis that defies gravity, and the other is suicide. There is a common core of moral and spiritual experience, whether you're an Eskimo or a Nordic, whether you're African-American or Western European, whether you're Asian or whether you're Indian, there is a common core of spiritual and moral experience. It's been written in stone, it's been written in gold, and it's been written in blood. We didn't all come from the same place, but we all came here with the same spiritual core. What, then, are the pragmatics of this emerging field of neurotheology? In other words, have we just overlooked this crucial and yet universal aspect in all our religions? Is there some empowerment to the individual that the religious teacher just cannot allow his flock to seize? Or is there no pragmatism to this to be had in something that is so subjective and yet objectively universal in every age and in the patrons of every single tradition in human history? I think there is. I think there is a pragmatism, but it is going to take a paradigm shift. How are we to interpret and understand forms of awareness that reach beyond biological senses or object-oriented consciousness? Well, I don't know. I think in different ways. We interpret it in music, we interpret it in poetry, we interpret it in dance. Every culture in every age has danced and sung. We interpret it and express it in our art. We interpret it and express it in our interpersonal relations with one another. But the key here is awareness. We must be self-aware in order to reach beyond these biological senses, this biological transducer. How does the notion of conscious states, independent of brain or bodily activity, play out in concrete terms for the people involved? I can tell you that it's fun. I can tell you that it's an experience. Even the pain is an experience, as long as you don't administer it to someone else. You're going through it, that's one thing. I can tell you, pain is a great teacher. It hurts. You don't have to have somebody tell you, don't do that again. These conscious states, the whole idea of this program, the whole idea of this hour, of the books that I wrote, and especially of Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is to let people know that they are in control of these conscious states. Yeah, it kind of runs wild, you know, like a 1.5-year-old that's hungry or sleepy or tired or frustrated or jealous. I mean, you're definitely reacting to the universe. You're not self-aware yet. But when you step in, when you step up against the eyes that are on the front of your face and you realize who you are, that you are who you are, that you're the real being in this body, in control, somewhere around 9 or 10, it varies with different people, somewhere in that self-awareness, you begin to take control of your conscious states. Oh, you'll still go through life reacting to all kinds of things. You'll still get mad when people push your buttons. You'll still get turned on when people push your buttons. But to master that, to control the eye, to control the lust of the eye, to control the lust of the flesh, because you want to, because you're self-aware and conscious and you control your conscious states. Why? Now you have control over your own health to a certain extent. Now you can instill in yourself an environment of health, an environment of joy, an environment of peace. And it will spread, because the other people around you, guess what? That's right. The universe acts on them, which means you act on them. Now, what kind of effect do you want to have? Taking it a little deeper, how do near-death experiences, as well as less dramatic but nonetheless spiritually transformative episodes witnessed by health professionals, affect the way people perceive reality and ascribe meaning to their lives? I mean, come on. We don't all have to have a near-death experience. I certainly don't want one. Do you? No. I mean, we can witness it. We can go to a conference and hear about it. We can read about it. And I can tell you most near-death experiences that I've listened to are pretty much the same. People come back quite transformed. But you don't have to have a near-death experience to have that happen. In the scriptures, it's called a mighty change of heart. If you're a student of the scriptures, you'll know fellows like, Paul, for instance. He was kind of on the wrong path, wasn't he? You know, lions, Christians, all that. And he got put on the right path. He got put on the right path. He wasn't seeking the right path. It hit him square between the eyes. Took him out for 3 days. And when he came back, that wasn't a near-death experience. That was a life-changing experience. But he had a mighty change of heart. So I'm saying that you can have it too. I'm saying that that's the pragmatic change that occurs in the spirit, in the body, that makes the weight fall off, that makes the smile return to your face, that makes you lose your temper, that makes you capable of grasping onto success in your life, and allows you to spread that success in various forms to other people. So I want you to call me tonight and tell me your thoughts about the idea that we are eternal beings, that we have risen above the physicality of this transducer we call the body. If we are eternal beings, why do we act like we're so afraid in this world? Why do we deal in fear with one another? Why can't we lay down our propensity to charge across the desert sands at one another with battle axes in hand? Human consciousness is a cerebral ability with inputs from the approximately 50 million cells that constitute an adult body. I think it's probably more like 50 billion. There is a growing understanding of the intelligence in individual cells and living matter. And by growing, I mean it's growing from its infancy. We understand very little about it. We do know that you can jerk the nucleus out of a living cell, and it will continue to live. It will continue to respirate. It will continue to defend itself against toxins and to eat, and eventually it will die. It won't reproduce because you took the nucleus out, but it functioned, which means the program, it's not in the nucleus. It's more than likely in the cell wall. But this is a growing study. We don't know that much about it, but we're gaining more knowledge about it as we go. Maybe a little insight here. Let's talk to Scott from Daytona Beach. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Hi, Dr. Brooks.
How you doing, Doc?
Good. I was doing some meditating today. As a matter of fact, I was thinking it was time to do some forgiveness. So there's a Lazarus meditation, Circle of Forgiveness, that I was doing. And there's also a self-forgiveness one that Lazarus has that I do from time to time. And I felt that that was kind of apropos to... I was in a rather dark mood, I think, Thursday night, Friday night, something, where I was thinking, okay, so we spend the eternity with our family.
Yeah.
But I cheered
had
myself
one of those
up.
Last Thursday.
I cheered myself up thinking, okay, I'm going to forgive, and then things will be better. So, I mean, there are certain family members who we think fondly of, and there are others who we think will be more challenging. But, in fact, I've had meditations and dreams with maternal grandparents popping up. In fact, my maternal grandfather's birthday was on November 8th, and I had a dream that night before his birthday where he came to me and telling me about a cold front coming in, which it did, that sort of thing. And, you know, it's... There are, you know, I have great fondness for, and I've experienced a lot of death. I'm only going to be 51 next Sunday, and there, you know, I've I've had colleagues pass, one younger than me, one a little bit older than me. It makes one look at one's mortality.
Well, it does. I mean, that's the one thing, when the last breath is taken by those around you. And, you know, I'll be 57 in May, so I'm, you know, seeing some of my friends, some of my high school buddies. I think there are 8 that are gone now. But, you know, various things. It does let you know, hey, you know, this biological transducer is going to not last forever. But I intend on giving it one heck of a ride.
And back to meditation, the forgiveness meditation, I noticed a profound difference in my life after doing it. It's a 4 or 5-step process where you put the person across from you in a circle and move about the circle, and gaining an understanding of why they did what they did, that being the key to forgiveness. And by understanding that, having that understanding of why, then that unlocks the door to forgiveness and the healing that can come about as a result of that.
Well, I agree with that. You know, that the whole act of forgiveness is so foreign to the unconscious mind. The unconscious, and of course, I mean, we're all conscious beings, but some of us are unconscious that we're conscious. We have a tendency to carry grudges. We get mad at a person and we never speak to them again. And gosh, I know family members that have done that to one another. That's nuts. I mean, you need to say tomorrow is a new day. It's brand spanking new. Forgive the other person. And the hardest one, like you mentioned, is forgiving yourself. You've got to forgive yourself and move on.
And I think right now in particular, I've been sensing the power of the future, in that truly when we open to the power of the future and the possible, we're opening to a tremendous amount of creativity, a tremendous amount of productivity, that which we have not yet conceived of or perceived of. And we're opening to
potentialities.
Yes, the potentialities of what could be, and so on and so forth, and to throw in expectation, the expectation of what could be, instead of Groundhog Day over and over again, which I think a lot of us get caught in,
where we drag the past
with us each day. We don't have to do that anymore. We can open to the possibility of the future, and each day can be a new experience, like we're surfing on a brand new wave each day.
Yeah, and don't be, you know, I caution, you know, Earth explorers, don't be the cynic. And I'm the worst offender. I mean, I mean, in the business that I'm in of, you know, trying to get a business started and, you know, being frustrated with access to capital and all the other challenges that you have, you know, I get a terminal case of cynicism about Wednesday afternoon. It's hard to shake off. Of course it's not easy, but you got to learn to do it. You have to learn to keep that intention alive and only respond to those things in the universe that are resonating with your intention.
Yes, and, well, I'm thinking that maybe other countries are going to have to kind of guide America in some ways, because I think in other countries, even though in Brazil it tears the engines up of the gasoline they use, whatever it is, ethanol or what have you, at least they don't have a pollution problem like we do. And I'm beginning to think maybe the surrounding nations might be the ones to help influence America to not necessarily convert totally to, you know, we don't want to alienate the oil people too much, because I know they want to have a stake in it too. But, you know, to share the wealth, truly. I mean, you know, that it's not only oil, but, it, you know, the electric and the wind and the solar and the whatever else, you know, becomes a piece of the pie here.
Well, I agree with that. And, I hear people on the mainstream media, you know, they excoriate additional forms of energy, that everything, wind and solar and biodiesel and all that's all a bunch of corruption, and it's never going to work. It's never going to create any jobs. Drill, baby, drill. That's where the economy is. I don't agree with that. I think we should move away from the hunter-gatherer mentality with respect to energy and start being domesticators. We need to have a renewable and clean way to drive to work every day, and it can be done.
Yes. I was working with one of my crystal skulls today. In fact, we've talked about that before. About a year ago, I called in, was telling you about all the skulls and so on and so forth. And the consciousness, I mean, they are, when working with skulls and crystals in general, there's a consciousness there. And I think that that's possibly where we can utilize a sense of vision of our own personal lives, thereby our global lives, when working with crystals and stones and the skull consciousness in particular. What I gathered, it was first used in Lemuria, the skull consciousness crystal, where that's how they recorded the records. They didn't use paper. They respected trees. They didn't chop them down. They stored information in the quartz. And then that quartz was later placed in other places, like in Brazil and Arkansas, and some probably brought to Atlantis. And then Atlantis, it was there that they were made into skulls. But it was essentially just quartz. It wasn't made in anything. They didn't polish things as much, I don't believe, in Lemuria as they... In Atlantis, it was more, you know, if it was skull consciousness, it needed to look like a skull. It was very as evidenced by. It was very scientifically, kind of like the way we are now, where if it's this way, then it must look like that. So that's when they started to make them. And from what I've gathered also, the great masters stored their consciousnesses in the skulls. There was kind of like a repository, I guess would be the word, or a conduit for the masters of the times in Atlantis. We're talking thousands of years here, thousands upon thousands of years, what I've gathered, from 65,000 to 10,000 B.C., somewhere around there, that the masters would use the skulls as a place to leave their consciousness or magnify their consciousness once they've left.
Yeah, I'm going to do a program on that. I just finished reading another book on that, which added a couple pieces that were missing for me. So we're going to do a program on that. I got some more lines stacked up, Scott, and I really appreciate your call. It's always enlightening to have you on.
Talk to you next time.
All right, Scott. Thanks so much.
Sure. Bye.
Goodbye. Hey, let's go to Susan in Colorado, line 3. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. Nice to speak with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Welcome to the program.
One of the questions I wanted to ask, and just to give a little bit of background, talking about awakening the mystical, the experiences that connect you with that, all that is, I guess that's what you would call it. But my mystical experiences came when I challenged God. I said I wanted to know what truth is, and I had gone to Bible school and had gone to church and was a fundamentalist Christian for 38 years, and I sat down on the couch one day and I said, God, where are you? I pray, I do it right, I've done it the way that the church taught me. I said, where's that God of miracles? Where's that God that parted the Red Sea? And I really challenged it, and I kind of had this thought that said, you know, I'm going to throw all my beliefs out the window, and God, I want you to show me what truth is. And no bells or whistles went off that day, but this steady awakening of mystical experiences began in my life that were just incredible. It was dreams and hearing inner guidance and awakening me to and teaching me how to love myself. I don't know, there was just this incredible thing of asking, if you call it asking the universe or asking God or the creator, that awoken the mystical experiences in my own journey was just amazing, and then letting go what I thought truth was.
Well, yeah, I see that you kind of had to let go of the bell a little bit. Once you strike it, you got to let it ring. And then, you know, a lot of people will hear it ring and they'll go, well, that's not the sound I wanted to hear. But at least you were open enough that, that message came to you and you went, oh, you mean there's a higher Susan? Well, how are you?
That's
and
right.
Then you become self-aware and you realize that, hey, I have more dimensions to myself. And I can actually experience life and put experience into life without being affected by the universe so much, wandering around in darkness. Part of me is in the light, and I'm going to bring that light in. So how did your life change after that?
Oh, amazingly so. The universe led my soulmate into my life. I awakened my ability to connect with people who had passed over. I actually do that as my work now, where I do what I call intuitive and spiritual readings and life guidance readings and connecting with loved ones. And the universe has led us to move from Virginia Beach to Sedona to Australia to back to Sedona and now in Colorado. And we're creating a spiritual retreat center, all by following that inner guidance, and it's been an amazing life.
I love that. That's awesome. So I have a question for you, because I have a friend, Dr. Mm-hmm. Gary Schwartz, who wrote the book, The God Experiment, and another book, which I escapes me at the moment. No, I'm not having a Rick Perry moment. I'm just thinking about something else. But we were talking about John Edwards, because he'd done some extensive experiments, most of which were double-blind studies and statistical experiments to verify the incredible ability that John Edwards has. And he came up with a very high 90 percentile that John Edwards was, in fact, authentic. But then I asked him a question during the interview. I said, Dr. Schwartz, why is it that John Edwards only makes connection with the most immediate generation? In other words, once the person's passed on, let's say it's Uncle Bob, Uncle Bob never comes and says, oh, by the way, when you get on this side, it's amazing because you can see everyone you've ever been. And I was once A, and just fill in the blank. He never does that. He only says, by the way, I'm here with the dog, and obey your mom and stay out of my stuff, you know, kind of message. Mm-hmm. But I believe he's making a connection, but I'm wondering why the dead that have passed on are not telling him about all the generations of lives that they have lived.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I don't know that the dead have ever told me that either. They usually come through with messages to help the person heal their grief, to be able to let them know that life goes on. And a lot of times it might just be that the person that is receiving the information is not ready to hear or not awake enough yet to be able to go that deep with them. Do you know what I mean? That's something that we do in our work, is once we've connected with someone and their loved one, we take them further into the spiritual awakening. Because usually the death of a loved one causes spiritual awakening. They start searching for answers. They start looking, and then we can take them into that experience, or lead to them to an experience of, you know, experiencing a past life regression or a past life reading. And so it seems to me that the after death communication reading is more about the newbie just waking up. Do you know what I mean? Because if you're already awake, you're already having those connections yourself. You know?
Sure.
You're already talking to dad. You're already, if you've already opened your flow, you know, from the divine through you and into your heart and those kind of things, people who are already awake already have those experiences and know those things. So
Yeah, but as you already experienced, you kind of have to make the move or be moved.
Correct.
Sort of beyond the religious into the spiritual.
Correct. And that's what our work does. We don't just go do readings with people. Those that are ready, we take them to that next level. How do I open myself up? How do I have those experiences with my loved one? How do I learn from the higher dimensions, my higher self, or those beings that are working with me? And so, you know, looking at John Edwards' work, and he's really good, and I'm associated with James Van Prague. I'm on his website as a recommended medium. They really do, but they focus just on that part, you know. The not taking them further, only that first connection of healing the grief and recognizing that life goes on.
Oh, right, right. I've got that. So you have to be in physical proximity of the person you're doing a reading for, or do you do it over the phone?
No. I do it over the phone. All of my work is done over the phone. Since Universe and Spirit has moved us up 8,000 feet up in the mountains in the San Luis Valley, it's very hard for people to get to us, but we do all the work on a phone, yeah.
Oh, that's outstanding. That's outstanding. Well, I would ask you to do a past life regression for me, but, you know, we're live on the radio, so I don't know if you want to do that or not.
Oh, no, but if you want, I'll be happy. And it's not a regression. It's just more of a reading. I just step in and see what's going on there, but I'm happy to offer you one if you would like one.
That would be cool. I'd love to do that. And then, you know, not just for my own edification, which, of course, I have grand curiosity about it, but I'm doing it as kind of a study, and it gives me a little bit more to ask Dr. Schwartz about when we do this next study.
Well, that will be perfect. I'll just email you and with my information, and we can set up a time. I'd be happy to do that. But interestingly enough, and I'm sure you get hundreds and hundreds of emails, but I had read your book, the Remembering the Future.
Yeah, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel.
Yeah, I listened to it, and I had an amazing experience listening to it. And when you were talking about your future, I don't know if it was a future life or a past life, but I was listening to it, and I was literally moved into time and recognized you as a friend from ancient past and ancient futures. It was like, it was so moving, I started crying because it was just so powerful. I go, oh, I know him. You know, I don't know you in this lifetime, never have spoke to you before, do you know what I mean? But it was like this incredible, just, I stepped out of time and I saw your soul and saw who you really were. And it was really a powerful, powerful connection just by listening to the CD.
Wow. I really appreciate that so much. And I do get a lot of emails, but I read everyone and I answer everyone.
Right.
They're so precious.
You did answer it. Yeah, you did answer it, and I'm sure you didn't remember it, but I just wanted to share with you that was one of those other mystical experiences that just kind of blew me away, because it was the first time I felt I had stepped out of this time into another time and experienced, you know, usually I can just read into it, or I go get the information and bring it back to the physical. This one was such, like, maybe 3 or 5 seconds of just stepping out of this time into the other and recognizing your soul. And I thought, oh, that's really cool.
Excellent. Excellent. I really appreciate it so much.
Yeah, and I do have a question.
Okay, sure.
And I know I've been trying to work on the Merkaba meditation. One of the things with my third eye, okay, is that at least in this form, I only see in black and white. I have not yet had a vision. Now, I've had really clear dreams and things like that in the dream state, but I'm looking for a way to awaken my pineal gland so I can move it out of the black and white kind of.
Are you doing the 18th breath okay?
I might not be, but I've not yet been able to move into that, you know, that full color spectrum out of the physical, disconnected with this physical into the vision, so to speak.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Actually, Drunvalo Melchizedek taught me how to do that by he had this cave that he launched from. And at the time, I had, you know, as you know from reading the book, this meadow that I went to in this sort of white piece of metal lawn furniture that I sat on. And then I started into this Merkaba or Merkaba meditation, and I got good at doing the breathing, and that's when this opened up. And it became so familiar to me. And, of course, as you know from reading the book, I've been back there thousands of times since then, so I have a lot of details. But I found the 18th breath, and I experimented with all kinds of things, and some of it I just darn near suffocated and became very uncomfortable. But I found that 12-second cycle breath that's talked about in the book sets up, I know it sounds so strange, but it sets up an electromagnetic cycle or vortex underneath the pineal gland. And in literally 2 or 3 minutes maximum, you feel yourself disconnecting and the colors begin to flow.
Right. I suspect I haven't spent enough time doing that 18th breath.
Well, the key is the timing. Remember the mudra that you put your hands into, the nested right. One hand inside the other, which you accomplish in the 14th breath of the Merkaba, and you stay in that, you know, all the way through to the 17th. Well, you just maintain that hand mudra. The other is to remember to put the tongue against the roof of the mouth and use it as a one-way valve. So you're inhaling through the nose and exhaling through the mouth. And what you're doing is you're breaking and making that electromagnetic connection between the fifth and sixth chakras over and over and over again. And it's like a spiral. It takes you in there.
Neat. Okay.
But don't do it while you're driving.
Okay. No, never will. All right. Well, cool. Well, I'll zip the email off to you. And thank you for answering my question and for letting me hear.
All right. Thank you so much, Susan. I appreciate your great words.
Thank you. Have a fun day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. We ran a little bit long on that hour, so I'm going to go ahead and we'll take a break right here and let me cough for a minute or two. Let's see. Let's play a little Sarah McLachlan here. This will be a good fit right here. We'll be back in about, 4.5 minutes. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio.
Take me out of darkness, out of doubt. I won't weigh it down with good intention.
Heaven.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. Little Sarah McLachlan, Witness, off her Surfacing album. If you want to be part of the program, it's 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America. If you can get to a cell phone tower on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-4511. In the last hour, we talked about the eternality of the soul, and that's, you know, probably one of the most important things that we'll go through in this lifetime, one of the things that we try to learn. We appreciated the phone call from Susan. Wonderful words, just kindness beyond measure, and I really appreciate it. I want you to be part of the Maya 2012 experience at Chichen Itza. Oh, yes. You don't want to pass this one up. December 13th through the 21st, a little over a year from now, 2012. I want you to be at Ground Zero. Ground Zero for 2012. December 21st, 2012. Be with me, Greg Braden. Power Places, Chichen Itza. All you have to do is go to X Squared Radio, find the Maya 2012 banner, click on it, and join us. We'll set up an easy plan for you to get all the money that you need to get on this trip. But let me tell you, we're leaving from Houston. We're going to the Yucatan, and you're coming with me. It's going to be an amazing 10 days. Trust me. You want to be able to tell your kids and your grandkids where you were on December 21st, 2012. You want to tell them you were at Ground Zero with me. I'm going to tell you all about it in the coming weeks, in the coming months. Put it on your calendar right now. Make your mind up. You're coming. All right. Thank you, Don. Sorry about that, people. Skype decided to not allow my board to work anymore. So that means that if we take calls, you'll be able to hear out there in radio land. But if you're listening to an archive in this last hour here at X Squared Radio, you won't be able to hear the caller. But that's fine. That's fine. We'll wing it. In this final, probably 25 minutes of the program, I want to finish talking about this consciousness, awareness, and some of the projects that have been done out there studying it. We're talking about some of the clinical ideas surrounding it. To arrive at consciousness, we have to enter the areas of the brain that contain memory, information, and emotion. Human memories go back to the primal soup and perhaps beyond, to the void before material creation. Scientists of various disciplines are involved in a worldwide research project that is trying to map all of the genes in the human DNA sequence. Another project, not so widely publicized, known as the Human Consciousness Project, is already well underway to map the gamut of human consciousness, including the unconscious. The latter project is also multidisciplinary, and researchers around the world are piecing together what they call a spectrum of human consciousness. Now, this includes instinct, ego and spirit, prepersonal, personal and transpersonal, subconscious, self-conscious, and superconscious. Thus, no state of consciousness is dismissed from its embrace. Undisputed evidence is already in hand that such a spectrum does exist. The first concept associated with consciousness is awareness. You heard Susan earlier talk about how she was an evangelical Christian for over 30 years. I was myself for about around 30 years, and this awareness occurred. It transcended everything, changed our hearts again. We weren't bad people.
We just realized that all those years we've been separated from God, we weren't really. We didn't need to be. We are conscious when we are aware. This is immediately seen to be not quite true. We may be aware, for instance, without really being conscious of being aware. I know how complicated that sounds, but you're a conscious being. You're just not conscious, you're conscious. Awareness is, therefore, only a part of consciousness. Other known aspects of consciousness are free will, reasoning, visual imagery, recalling, and agency, or making choices. We make choices all the time. Super salad, right or left, hamburger or taco. Do I get mad or don't I get mad? Oftentimes, we're just reacting to the universe. We're reacting instead of acting upon the universe. We're making choices based upon stimulus that comes to us. If we're fully aware, we will assess that stimulus, realize that it is what it is, and then we will make our choice independent of that stimulus. It is now widely accepted that all knowledge, heavily edited to include only that which is useful to human life, from the beginning of time, is available to each of us. All knowledge, an intelligence that is carried at the cellular, subatomic level. Highly evolved individuals who have touched the hem of the eternal and communed with the infinite through their higher consciousness, made that quantum leap, but have been unable to transfer their understanding due to limitations imposed by language. Because language is incomplete and fragmentary, merely registering a stage in the average advance beyond the ape mentality. But all of us do have flashes. Some of them are microseconds. Some of them last for a few minutes or a few hours. But this insight beyond meanings already stabilized in etymology and grammar. We can see that. We can experience that. And the more you experience it, and the better your language skills are, the better your ability to change the pictures that you see in your mind into words, the better your ability to communicate it, not only to yourself, but to others. And I hate to plug the book, but Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel is just such a book. It takes that flash of memory, that flash of connection that you experience when all this knowledge is open to you and allows you to picture it in your mind. And if you can picture it in your mind, you can tell the story. You can get it out to others where they can understand it and feel it the way you do. That's all I try to do in the book. And I'm happy to report that it still remains in the top 100 on Amazon in its genre, which is, I admit, a very narrow genre, but it's there nonetheless. And if you don't want to buy it through Amazon, I recommend buying it from the website, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Why? Well, because you get the audiobook for free and you get it autographed. So go to rememberingthefuturebook.com and make an easy purchase, and purchase one as a Christmas gift for your family and friends. I'm really telling you, you can see a difference once they learn the tools that it takes to crack this egg and get inside and begin to feed off of it. Our brain is domineering when it comes to coping with reality. I mean, come on. If we don't see it, we don't believe it. We don't hear it, we don't believe it. We don't taste it for ourselves, we don't believe it. Our brain is domineering because it's the biological transducer through which we interpret the universe. But we sometimes see things not as they really are. Sometimes we invent categories that do not exist. And sometimes we fail to see things that are really there. There are people who have never seen or heard of an aircraft and will not be able to imagine it. And a real airplane overhead will be distorted in their minds, creating alternative realities. Giant birds or who knows what. to recognize that what we call reality is only a consensus reality. In other words, it's just over the majority. Only what we have agreed to call reality is to recognize that we can perceive only what we can conceive. According to neurobiologist William Calvin, the human mind, in all likelihood the seat of consciousness, located in the brain, and that's controversial, it could be located just above the body, it could be located just outside the body, in a kind of spirit body that is encased over the physical body, or a spirit body just inside the body, or inside the heart. It's so complex that we have only just begun to understand bits and pieces of it. My teacher, Drun Valo Melchizedek, my master teacher, Maureen St. Germain, taught me more about these concepts than anyone else I've ever met. I highly recommend looking them up and taking a class from them if you really want to understand the deeper concepts of this. But the human mind is not located in the gray matter of your head. It's just outside of it. It is remarkable that despite the advancements of ancient civilizations in India, China, Mesopotamia, and Greece, the discovery of the crucial importance of the brain as the seat of thought and action did not feature in human knowledge until barely two centuries ago. The navel, the liver, and the heart were revered instead by different cultures at various times. It's important to note that the heart has gray matter. It isn't all muscle. It has a portion of gray matter, just like your brain. Consciousness is the most advanced event in the history of evolution. But we cannot separate it from the spirit, mind, or brain. In Western science, to put it simply, consciousness is the output of the mind, which is an aspect of the brain. And this is the wrong track. Consciousness depends heavily on memory, which is very tricky and can be full of holes, patched up more often than not by fantasy. Memory is also selective. Just ask any spouse, and often faulty. We paint rosy pictures of incidents, events, and people when it suits us, and we also do the exact opposite. Terrible memories when nothing of the sort actually exists. The fact that some of our memories, true ones, because no imagination is involved, go back several billion years to the Procrustean age, while others belong to just a few moments ago, it only adds to its mysteriousness. Muddying the waters even further is our emotions. Our feelings color our consciousness as much as our memories do. Emotions are really reactions to external stimuli. You cannot feel an emotion in a vacuum. Even loneliness presumes that you have known togetherness. So it appears that our consciousness needs the other, even if the other is your own mirror image or parts of your body or bodily functions. It needs an external environment. It needs language, an environment with something outside of self. Consciousness, therefore, presumes an entity that is aware of something, including itself. This goes back to the very primal concepts of original source. Source was unaware, regardless of its omniscience, regardless of its omnipotence. It was a singularity, unaware of anything else because nothing else existed besides it. It didn't have anything to compare to, and so it divided itself. It didn't divide itself in two, it took the square root of itself. This is a completely different concept. It only exists in that concept in remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel. Every other concept out there says source divided itself in two equal parts by cutting itself in half. Didn't happen. It was a square root. Yes, they're two equal parts, but it's one multiplied by the other. And when you continue to do this over and over and over again, you get absolutely matched pairs. Soulmates divided one from another. Yes, it's all still a singularity. Of course it is. It's all one big mathematical equation that can be folded back into itself, back to the singularity. It's consciousness that slowed everything down and allowed distance to occur. It's consciousness that allowed things to slow down slower than the speed of light so that time could exist, so that we could savor our existence for a moment, maybe 100 years, which is less than a moment in the universe. It's human consciousness that created all this. The whole physical universe that we can perceive only makes up 5% of the universe. The rest of it is all collapsed into dark matter and dark energy, which may actually be very super bright energy or bright matter. We just can't perceive it. So the idea behind this is that we don't know, but we can imagine. And if we can imagine, we can begin to perceive. And if we can begin to perceive, we can begin to have perspective of ourself, ourself with that source. And that's why I always say, remember, you are source. You are not separated from it. You are a mathematical piece of the equation in it. So when we understand the mind, we understand the consciousness, we understand that we are aware and awake in that consciousness. Now, our choices, our conscious choices, begin to shape the universe. From the conscious awareness of an infant to its immediate environment, recognizing its mother as apart from others, for instance, levels of consciousness rise as we grow. The key is to continue to grow. Now, Colin Wilson suggests at least 8 degrees of consciousness from 0 to 7. Find out where you are. Here we go. They are level 0, deep sleep. Level 1, dreaming or hypnagogic. When you're in hypnagogia, it's that level between sleepfulness and wakefulness. It's actually an area in which you can take in knowledge and remember it, both long-term and short-term memory. It's a great place to learn chemistry, let me tell you. Level 2 is mere awareness or unresponsive waking state. Level 3, self-awareness that is dull and meaningless. Oh, now, come on, put your hands down. Level 4, passive and reactive, normal consciousness that regards life as a grim battle. Life is crap, and then you die. Okay, I see your hands out there. Leave them up if you want to, that's fine. I'm going to read level 5 anyway. Level 5, an active, spontaneous, happy consciousness in which life is exciting and interesting. Okay, I'd put my hand up right here, except I know there's 2 more levels, and I can't wait to hear about them. You see, life is exciting and interesting, partly because you're listening to X Squared Radio. You tuned in. You got squared. All right, level 6, a transcendent level where time ceases to exist. Wilson does take note of further levels of consciousness as experienced by mystics, but gives no details. Wait a minute. That's not fair. There are 7 levels to consciousness. So 7 is the unnamed level of consciousness, somewhere above where you find life to be exciting, and somewhere above a transcendent level where time ceases to exist. Sounds like the singularity to me. Sounds like your consciousness has achieved the speed of light, where literally time slows down to nothing, and the entire universe collapses back into its original singularity. Very interesting stuff. Well, very interesting stuff, but you see the shortcomings of Mr. Wilson. He needs a Dennis the Menace to mix things up a little bit. Read the book, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, and you'll get it. All right, there's also a cosmic consciousness. Canadian psychologist Richard M. Buick, in his book Cosmic Consciousness, coined this term. I know a lot of people that would make that claim as well. It is a transpersonal mode of consciousness, an awareness of the universal mind and one's unity with it. Its prime characteristic is a consciousness of the life and order in the universe. An individual who attains this state is often described as enlightened, and such a person is also said to have a sense of immortality, not of attaining it, but of already having it. Burke saw the state of consciousness as the next stage in human evolution, very much as spiritualists have always seen it. I had an evangelical Christian who was doing some temporary work for me a couple of months ago, said, you know, you seem like a pretty bright guy, but I'm concerned. I said, really? For what? I'm concerned with how you're going to spend eternity. I said, eternity? Aren't we like halfway through it now? And he said, no, absolutely not. You haven't even started it yet. He didn't get it. He didn't understand at all. An enlightened person already has a sense of immortality. Already has it. Indian yogis and mystics classify the seven states of consciousness differently. They point out that human beings normally experience only three states: sleeping, dreaming, and waking. In meditation, fleetingly, you get to experience turiya, literally the fourth state, or transcendental consciousness, commonly known as samadhi. When this state coexists and stabilizes with the other three, that's the fifth state, where I consciousness expands to become cosmic consciousness. The sixth state is God consciousness, whereby you see God everywhere in everything. And the last is unity consciousness. What is within is also outside. Pure consciousness, and nothing else is. Spiritually, consciousness is as vast as the universe and as small, both known and unknown. The potential power of this level of consciousness has been merely touched upon, and that too by a few mystics. Consciousness at this level becomes capable of magical powers, defying accepted scientific physical laws and giving us a glimpse of probable future developments in, among other things, you got it, quantum physics. And that's where my friend Amit Goswami comes in. He is the quantum activist. We've had him on the program. You need to go back and listen to that interview if you can get through it. He's a very, very deep speaker. I recommend the book, though, Quantum Activist. The book is super well written, and it will take you on a quantum physical trip that you will understand because it's written in pretty plain language. We are out of time for this program tonight. This is November 13th, 2011. I like to put the date in there so that if you're listening to an archive, you can remember where we are. Some producers like to not put the date in there so that the episode or the program sequence is timeless. But I like to put it in time perspective, sort of link it to where we are with the development of humanity and this metamorphosis that we're going through. Please don't forget Maya 2012. Watch for the banner. Join me at Chichen Itza. Pick up the book, Remembering the Future. We're on our way, people. We're on our way. It's my pleasure to have you here on X Squared Radio. We'll now play our exit music. Thank you so much for being part of X Squared Radio. We'll see you next week, right here.
It has been a great to have you here with us this evening. Because every Sunday evening...
Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, Peace, Earth Explorers.